coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I have this condition.
Which comes first, memory or the cell?
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No. It's different from that. I have no short-term memory. I know who I am. I know all about myself. Since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades.
The philosopher John Locke taught that memories establish the identity of a person.
How do we distinguish real memories from false memories?
Memories are reliable.
Oh, please.
No, really. Memories aren't perfect. It's not even that good.
Can I only remember events that I myself experienced?
Look, memory can change the shape of a room. It can change the color of a car. And memories can be distorted. They're just an interpretation. They're not a record.
Is the self just a construct we create to tie all our memories together?
Our guest is Stan Klein from UC Santa Barbara.
Memory and the self.
Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Carry on conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. That's where Ken is a professor of philosophy, while I'm a professor at UC Riverside.
Today, we're asking about memory and the self.
Ken, there's a long tradition in philosophy that says that memory and the self are intimately connected. John Locke, for example, claim that what makes me today the very same person I was yesterday is basically the fact that I can remember doing the things I did and experiencing the things I experienced yesterday. So for Locke, memory is what actually determines who I am.
But John, doesn't that have the implication that if I can't remember doing something, then I didn't do it? Frankly, I can't remember half the things I did during certain periods of my youth that were spent, well, in, let's say, something of a haze, I admit. But surely it was me and nobody else who did all those stupid things.
Well, you've put your finger on a big problem for Locke's theory, if we take it completely literally. But I still think he got something really important right.
And now that would be what?
Well, his concept of a person. A person, he says, is a thinking, intelligent being that has reason and reflection, that's introspection, and can consider itself as itself, the same thinking thing in different times and places.
That sounds nice as far as it goes, but doesn't that leave out something?
Well, what?
The self. Locke tells us what the self does, but he doesn't tell us what the self is. What exactly is that mysterious thing that's doing these two things, considering and being considered, when we, to use his own words that you like so much, consider ourselves as ourselves? What is the self, John?
Well, I see the problem, but I think it lies in yourself and not with Locke. You're thinking of the self as some mysterious inner agent, but in that sense, I don't think there is a self.
Oh, come on, haven't you read your Descartes, John? Come on, doubt the world if you like. Doubt the body if you must, but never doubt the self. The self is indubitable, sir.
Well, what I don't doubt is that you and Descartes are confusing having a self-conception with having a thing called the self. We all have self-conceptions, but there's no such thing as an inner self.
Oh, come on. How could there be self-conceptions if there was nothing to have a conception of, if there was no self? How could that be?
Well, because a self isn't something a person has. A self is something a person is. Myself is just me considered from my point of view. Yourself is just you. You don't think you're inside yourself, do you? Suppose I ask you who Ken Taylor is. What does he want? You can answer those questions, can't you?
Well, of course I can.
So tell me, to come up with those answers, you have to roll your eyes inward and inspect some inner self? Do you have to read a book or do elaborate research? You have to rely on the testimony of others?
Don't be silly, John. Don't be silly. That's silly stuff.
That's because you have the capacity to do just what Locke was talking about. The capacity to consider yourself as yourself, or as I like to put it, to form I thoughts.
I thoughts? I guess you mean something like the capacity to think, I am tall, I am hungry, I am handsome.
Exactly. Having that capacity is all it takes to make you a self. It's the basis of your self-conception. And that doesn't require the existence of any mysterious inner agent.
John, but look, if there is no actual inner self, how do you explain how I know myself better than anything else? How it's so indubitable, as Descartes said. What guarantees that my self-conceptions are true? For all you've said, they could just be made up. They could be false.
Well, our self-conceptions are often quite erroneous, and they actually are remarkably fragile things.
What do you mean by that fragility thing?
Well, think of the late stage of Alzheimer's patients who can't remember much before the present moment. Or think of a schizophrenic who did something and remembers that thing, but he remembers it as being done by someone else.
Yeah, that's weird stuff you're talking about. Now, I don't think your buddy Locke, who you admire so much, thought much about the ways in which memory issues like that can alter or distort our self-conceptions.
Well, probably not, and not too many philosophers have. But to help us think about this underexplored connection between memory and the self, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, in search of an answer to the question, who exactly do you become when memory goes awry? She files this report.
A few years ago, banker White, a filmmaker in the San Francisco Bay Area, noticed something was off with his mother, Pam.
The frequency with which she'd lose her keys and get lost when she was driving from one place to the other, coupled with the inability to figure out how to solve the situation on her own. My mom was a very young, vibrant, independent, late 50-year-old woman at the time.
The family took Pam to doctors, but there was no clear diagnosis. They watched for years, helplessly, as her memory degraded. Then came the personality changes and the violent outbursts.
By the time she got an Alzheimer's diagnosis, it was kind of a relief.
Hello, I am Pam White. I am the mother of three children. I will tell you a little bit about me.
Banker White's film, The Genius of Marion, documents his mother's struggle with a disease as it steals her memory.
Initially, I was quite distressed and upset about it. But it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really change anything. So I don't feel sad and I don't feel regret. I feel blessed.
There's a scene in the film where Pam visits her doctor.
How is her memory?
Perfect.
The perfect.
The doctor asks her a series of questions to test her memory.
And can you tell me what year it is?
This is the one that makes me mad, because it's something I should know immediately.
That's tough, yeah. I know. Can you come up with it, or it's escaping you at this point?
Tell me again.
What year is it?
19-something.
Okay.
The doctor then asks Pam's husband, her primary caretaker, if he needs help around the house. Pam isn't too happy about the idea of a stranger coming into her home. You can start to see the toll her illness has taken on those around her.
There are just some things I'm not that good at. You know, I don't know how to put your makeup on.
Mm. You're really good at it.
Yeah, that's what you say. I do dress you, but I'm not that good at it. Uh-huh. You know, the showers and the baths and all that stuff is...
I think the problem is that I am... Like my, how do you say it? Pride.
What made the diagnosis particularly wrenching was that Pam had watched her own mother, Marion Steele, die of Alzheimer's just 6 years before.
I think that was the most difficult period of my mom's life.
Again, banker White.
I don't think she had quite processed it.
In the few years since the documentary was filmed, Pam's disease has progressed. She's less mobile now and has severe visual spatial impairment. She needs 24-hour care.
But her spirit is actually much improved in the sense that all of the kind of fear and the really intense emotions around shame and the amount of energy that she put into that to try and hide her deficits from other people has totally fallen away. It's more painful for us to see my mom change at this point because she doesn't experience that anymore.
Banker says he and his mother have new ways of communicating.
She really likes to hold hands now. She's less verbal than she used to be, and she likes to squeeze my hand, and I feel like we kind of play this game where she squeezes my hand and I squeeze it back, and even that tiny interaction can hold humor.
When a person loses her memory and can no longer recall her own life experiences, Who does she become?
I don't think my mom is a new person. And I don't think that she's diminishing from who she was to being less of that person. I really believe that there's something that's essentially my mother that's still there.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're asking about memory and the self. We're joined now by Stan Klein. He's a professor of psychology and brain sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And most importantly, he's an affiliate of the philosophy department there. And he's author of The Two Selves, Their Metaphysical Commitment and Functional Independence. Stan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Stan, you're a very philosophically sophisticated psychologist, and you've done a lot of work on memory and its relation to our sense of self. But if you can remember this far back, what got you interested in this question in the first place?
Well, I'm not sure what particularly got me interested. One revealing fact is that I was born with high-functioning Asperger's, and so didn't always have the same interests that my peer group had. I was always interested in temporality, time, what it meant, where it was it absolute, relative, etc. And when I got to grad school, which I kind of fell into more than selected, that's a long story I not need to go into, I became interested in time, and that rapidly became relevant, the memory rapidly became relevant to that. And then time and memory sort of led to interest in the self and consciousness, all the things with save for memory, which psychologists largely avoid. And it became clear to me, at least, that these four, and they may be reducible, but these four concepts of time, self, memory, and consciousness are all part of a big, very mysterious picture, and I've just sort of gone with it.
Well, I'm glad for that sequence of events as a philosopher who's learned a lot from your work. Now, Ken, poor fellow, seems to be an advocate of some sort of mysterious inner self. Myself, I think the self is just me. As Pogo might say, I've met the self and it's me. As a psychologist who studies how our actual self-conceptions work and how memory works, which side do you fall on? Ken's, the wrong side, or mine, the right side?
Oh, this is great, because the answer is yes. as I say in my new book, available at Amazon, you'll be one of the four people who have read it if you get it. It is not an either-or question. In fact, I take a sort of a Fichtean stance that objectivity and subjectivity, both or an objective or subjective aspect, are both required. And I see memory as sort of the neurological underpinnings of some aspects of the self, but memory absent a consciousness, which I will conflate with a sense of self, because when that consciousness takes as its object self-memory-based, and not necessarily memory-based, it can be emotional, there's a lot of other sources, but these sort of neurally instantiated and scientifically observable aspects of the self, when those two come together, we get self-consciousness, we get self-awareness, and I think absent that consciousness, those content of memory would have little meaning, and absent absent the content, then the consciousness would have no, as Brentano might say, intentional objects to inform it. So I think that the self is a combination of both the subjective part that Ken talks about and the more scientifically quantifiable objective part that you mentioned.
So just for our listeners, our very erudite guest refers to Fichte, whose first name I forget, maybe it was Sam. Fichte, the great exponent and critique of Immanuel Kant, who wrote during the last part of the 18th and first part of the 19th century.
Well, we're going to have to dig into this. There's a lot here. It's refreshing, though, that you, as some psychologists say, some neural people say, there is no such thing as a self, but you have a much more nuanced view than some of your colleagues have. So we'll have to dig into that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about memory and the self with Stan Klein from UC Santa Barbara.
Are you the same person who did something in the past only if you remember doing it? And is it only possible to remember doing something you yourself did? And what's so special about memories of your own actions anyway?
Memory, consciousness, and the self. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Memories are made of this. Memories are made of this.
Well, if that's what memories are made of, what's the self got to do with it? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're looking at the connection between memory and the self.
Our guest is Stan Klein from the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's the author of The Two Selves.
So, Stan, I want to ask you about Locke's thing about the connection between memory and the self. I can remember lots of people's actions that aren't mine. I can remember Obama's actions, John's actions. I can remember Bush's actions. They appall me a lot. But that has nothing to do with me. So, but is there some special kind of memory that is, you know, reserved for self memory? And what do you think about that?
Well, there's several ways of unpacking that. First, there are certain memories that simply are, in terms of the content of the memory, are relevant to the self in a variety of ways. Either you're directly part of the memory, or it's part of a situation. I mean, although this may end up in an infinite regress, it's part of the situation that, which, by the way, is part of Locke's problem. There are situations which you know to be self-relevant. We don't need memory in order to have a sense of self for a couple of reasons. One is there is no memory. There are different aspects of memory, and those different aspects can contribute in different ways to different aspects of ourselves.
Well, let me just break in there for a second,
yeah,
Stan.
Ahead,
I mean, so I remember that Ken started this segment. Mm-hmm. I remember Ken starting this segment. And I also remember my saying something. Now, Are those just the same kind of memory, except one's about Ken and one's about me? Or is there really some different kind of memory involved in the case in which I remember doing something myself? I mean, you said there's different kinds of memories. Do they correspond to that distinction?
Not necessarily. There is memory as associated content that this happened. It is mine in the sense that I can identify that content as being part of me. It is also given to me in consciousness as my memory due to the manner in which this content is taken by consciousness, by which I mean I have patients who can remember specifically what they did, when they did, where they did it, but they don't own their memories. Now, that's hard to understand.
No, I think I get you, and I think John is pointing to an important point, and I think this is something that Locke kind of missed, and that's why his theory of personal identity, as interesting as it is not exactly right. But John said the important thing about Locke, the important thing he got right was consider itself as itself. That's that first personal thing. That first personal thing is prior to memory. I mean, I can remember John doing something. Somebody could tell me, oh, Ken Taylor did this. This is just the kind of thing you were talking about, I think. Ken Taylor did this. I think, oh, yeah, Ken Taylor did that. And I remember Ken Taylor doing it. But if I don't know that I'm Ken Taylor, then I don't remember that I did it. So I can kind of dissociate the memory that Ken Taylor did it. The first person isn't, I don't think it's captured by memory. It precedes memory. Does that seem right?
Precedes memory.
Yeah, I mean, it's prior to memory. I don't mean temporally precedes, but
I don't think it's prior to memory. I think it's contingently related. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's intrinsic to memory. I think it's a creation that happens when the content is made available to awareness. And I think that because I have many cases, some in the schizophrenic domain of thought intrusion, that's a classic depersonalization, other dementias in which the selfness of the memory separates from the content. And so I know it. I know it's about me from the content, but I don't take it as my own. It doesn't appear to me to be my own personally owned memory.
And one of the things I found really fascinating in some of your case studies it kind of goes the other direction. That is, you have somebody, maybe an Alzheimer's patient, who doesn't have this kind of event memory of previous actions that Locke is interested in, but has still a pretty good conception of their own personality and things like that. Can you say a little bit about those cases?
Sure. I mean, Alzheimer's is a whole separate issue we could get into, and it would divert us a bit. The idea that Alzheimer's entails a loss of self is a misinterpretation, I believe, of the data. I mean, I came with this, with empirical evidence many years ago, and it's now, I guess, relatively accepted, which doesn't make it true. But I have amnesic patients who cannot remember a single thing they have ever done at any point at any time in their life, as is a friend of mine, Endel Tolving, in Canada. And these people, despite being unable to episodically, which is a type of memory we're referring to, the ability to remember that I originally acquired the experience and what the experience was, still maintain sense of identity. I mean, they are not they are confused about what happened in their life. They're unable to report it. There is no connectivity or continuity as per Locke, but they still have a sense that I am I, and these horrible things are happening to me, which gets back to the idea that it is not memory, it is not the Descartesian immaterial self, which people don't like because, you know, it has soul connotations, and that gets us into religious questions. It doesn't have to, but you need both. But you can have one or the other. They can separate.
Right, and most of us have both. And that's kind of I'm going to use two fancy words that aren't really all that fancy. Diachronic and synchronic. Diachronic, over time, I have this sense of self unfolding over time, and synchronic, I have a conception of myself, my total state of being at this moment. I believe this, I want this, I want that, that's all a moment. But, you know, my life develops, and I have this unfolding narrative of my life. It seems that the Alzheimer's patient hasn't lost the synchronic integration of all her current states into one that are all hers, but she has lost something about the ability to keep updating that narrative, hasn't she? And most of us have both these things, but if they can come apart, I don't know what to say about the self.
Well, in part, what happens in Alzheimer's, one thing that can happen in Alzheimer's is because certain aspects of memory are lost, and they're temporally graded, so the last in or most recent gets lost first. They show no knowledge of what they are, what they've become. You know, okay, how long have you been at this clinic? A week, 4 years, 14 years, you know, they've lost the ability to update what's going on, but they maintain knowledge of what they were like prior to the onset of the disease. Now, as the disease progresses, it gets worse and worse. But that sort of sense that, but I am synchronically I, there's always that Alzheimer's person in there who is scared, worried, confused by the breakdown of the neural machinery at various stages.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing memory and the self with Stan Klein from UC Santa Barbara. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Mary from Mill Valley's on the line. Welcome to a Philosophy Talk, Mary.
Hello. I want to say that I don't understand what you're talking about. How about that for an opener? I'm a 93-year-old woman with a very good memory, actually. Of my past and present, and I still can remember new phone numbers, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm calling about, what is confusing to me, is that you never mention the brain. And I don't understand where there is anything in self or memory if you do not talk about the brain. And am I missing what you're talking about? I guess that's where my question is.
Good question. I will say that Stan is a professor of psychology and brain scientist. So Stan knows a lot about the brain. We just haven't talked about it yet.
Well, I actually have. I mean, I've talked about memory as neurally instantiated. Mm-hmm, that's right. A funny word for neurally composed. And by neural, I don't mean the neurons in your gut. I mean, it's possible, but I'm talking about the brain itself. And but you don't have your memories, you don't have your emotions, you don't have a lot of things if you don't have a brain.
But there is a crude, I'm going to call it a crude scientism, a crude reductionism. That's that thing. This is what leads some people to say, well, there is no such thing as a self, because we can't find anything in the brain, localized in the brain, that could count as the self. So you look inside there, there's nothing that has this unified simplicity in the brain. But, I mean, what do you think about that way of thinking about what it takes to have a self? There's got to be a locus in the brain of selfhood.
I don't see... I mean, that's a dogma, and it's probably a materialist reductionist dogma. And the idea that all reality is reducible to materialism is nothing more than, has no more empirical or logical warrant than a Descartes position, which most Western science rails against. I think that you do need to have neural structures to provide evidence for awareness. I don't know how awareness is taken, but I don't believe that just because you have a neurally embodied system that it requires a place. I don't think, A, there is a self. I think there are different aspects of self. Secondly, I don't know that there is a place in the sense of a system, because I don't know why a system has to be localized. It can be widely spread. It could be the whole brain in unity for all I know. And third, we're no better with memory. I mean, we talk about memory, but because we have such ill definitions of memory, we think we can locate memory, but it's very hard to find something when you're not sure what you're looking for.
Well, let me say about Mary's questions is it really puts our conversation in a broader context. Philosophers have been thinking about the mind forever. Aristotle thought about the mind, and Aristotle thought the brain was a radiator for cooling blood, and all the functions that we attribute to the brain, he attributed to the heart. When Locke was writing, I think he knew that the brain was a lot more important than that, but he didn't know anything about the brain. Now, so philosophers have been thinking about the mind for a long time, but now we're pretty much convinced that the mind is the brain. It's either identical with the brain or it's really intimately acquainted with the brain. God, that's awful. That means philosophers have to look at all this stuff that people are discovering about the brain. For a long time, we said, well, let's concentrate on is. The mind is the brain. We can think about is. Is that real identity or something else? But Stan is one of these people. Pat Churchland at UC San Diego is another one. Who is forcing us to think as philosophers about the impact of our greatly extended knowledge, we in the sense of the intellectual community, about the brain. So it's a great question, Mary.
And it's a good thing. It's a good thing to do that, but you don't want to oversimplify, as Stan said. We've got another caller on the line. Chris from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Hi, thank you, and love the show. So I just had an experience that sort of put the finger on brain versus self. I dislocated my shoulder once, and when I went to the emergency room, I was given an anesthetic that I'm told left me, semi-conscious, but retarded my ability to form any memory. So when they stretched my shoulder out and put my arm back in the socket, I'm told I was semi-conscious, but I have no recollection of it at all. So if you were to ask the conscious me who's talking to you now, did that happen? I would say I have no record, no recollection of that happening. But obviously, my left shoulder has been back in the pocket for years now. So
yeah,
it wasn't before that episode. So something must have happened.
Good question, Chris. And Stan, it raises a general point I want to get your thoughts on, and John's reaction to. Look, Descartes could believe that the self had immediate access to itself, kind of because it was this separate thing, and it kind of had this inward eye, and it was indubitable and infallible with respect to itself. Once you start singing, well, he's not talking about the sense of self, somehow constructed out of consciousness and memory and experience and all that, then you can start to wonder, well, gee, where does this sense of self, I mean, what goes into this sense of self, and is it true and is it accurate? Is it complete or incomplete? I mean, it starts to become a lot less powerful than the Cartesian self-knowing self, because these self-conceptions are subject to all kinds of things. We go in and out of consciousness. We misconceive our experiences. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I guess first the idea that we are intimately acquainted with our introspective knowledge, you know, the I forget the exact term for it, but it's a, a well-known part of philosophical study. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. That doesn't say anything about the truth of the introspection, however. The from an evolutionary standpoint, truth is not particularly interesting. What's interesting is what works and what gets us to survive and propagate. So there's no necessary reason, and psychologists since Munsterberg in 1909 and Bartlett in 1932 have known this. Memory is constructed. It's not a veridical snapshot of reality, nor should it be, nor need it be. What it needs to be is what works. Now, of course, it has to have some overlap with reality. If I believe I can fly and jump off the top story of the Empire State Building, I'm not going to propagate very well unless I've already achieved that. So,
unless you do it on the way down.
But how much pressure? Okay, but once you start thinking this way, how much pressure is there on my self-representation, my self-conceptions, to actually be true? And what would it mean for them to be true if there's no like inner thing that they're kind of corresponding to?
Let me just interject there. We've got an email on this point from John in Berkeley. He says, "If I remember that Nixon's vice president was Himmler, if I say I remember that Nixon's vice president was Himmler, do I remember that Nixon's vice president was Himmler?" And I think the answer is no. In our concept of memory is what philosophers call a veridical concept. It doesn't count as remembering unless it's true. But that doesn't mean that the human facility that underlies these false memories isn't the same. It's the faculty of memory. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it leads us astray.
Yeah, I mean, memory and imagination are very likely to be on a continuum where the memory end is closer to the constraints that are given by both our internal constitution, our genetics, and the environment. I mean, there are things that lead memory to be more closely aligned to quote-unquote reality. But that doesn't mean memory needs to be veridical. It means it needs to be closely aligned, and how I get there, what I remember, is not necessarily going to be selected for. In fact, people who study false memory in the last year or so have become attuned to this, and you start seeing this in the writings on false memory, that there's no reason to believe memory is veridical, and in fact, studying false memory may be somewhat of an oxymoron.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about memory and the self with psychologist Stan Klein from UC Santa Barbara.
What's the best way to study the connection between memory and the self? Philosophy and reading dead philosophers? That's the way I like to do it. But maybe we philosophers should just leave all the study of memory to psychologists.
Philosophy, psychology, and the self. When Philosophy Talk continues.
People, places, memories. What more could a self need? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Stan Klein from UC Santa Barbara, and we're asking about memory and the self, and we've got a caller on the line, Mike in El Cerrito. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to observe that I don't think that I will ever forget, or at least not until a very advanced stage of dementia, that fire will burn me. That memory is not likely to go away, whereas what I was wearing at my high school prom or something like that is something that I may never, at this point, be sure that I accurately remember or that I just remembering. So is there a sort of post-Darwinian concept of memory and the self, that the self has a relationship with memory that is essential to survival, procreation, and so on?
Well, thanks.
And that other things that we call memory are a product of social constructs or something.
Thanks for the question, Mike. There's a lot there. But Mike's distinguishing, it sounds to me, like two kinds of memory. You know, what happened to me and sort of the structure of the world, fire will burn me. Can you help us with a distinction? Is there a distinction like that?
Sure.
Like to make?
No, there's a distinction that goes under maybe several dozen different names. I'll pick the episodic semantic name. There are different systems of long-term memory that can come apart or dissociate. I work with patients all the time like this. Semantic memory is knowledge. The sun is hot. NaCl is salt. 2 + 2 = 4. The meaning of the word dog is a mammal with four legs and barks. Knowledge, not necessarily true justified belief, but just facts about the world, not necessarily personal, but they can be. And that's actually an important aspect of memory itself. But episodic memory, let me just get this. Episodic memory is a different aspect of long-term memory that entails a sense of what I did, when I did, and where I did it, at least by the current
right.
conception.
Now, go back to your Alzheimer's patient who can remember what she's like. Isn't that sort of semantic memory of oneself? I mean, knowing what my... That's like
yes.
knowing that fire will burn me, knowing that I'm a grouch, and knowing that I'm kind is more like that, right?
Yes. Yes, she's able to, for instance, reliably and accurately describe herself in terms of her trait characteristics, provided that those descriptions are prior to her dementia. If you ask her what she's like now, which won't have any meaning to her, if you ask her what she's like, she gives you answers that don't correlate with anything. But if you ask her what she was like for the previous 35 years, other people can confirm that to be the case, despite the fact she has lost that aspect of the self that's narratively given, which is episodic. What did I do and when did I do it? She knows she was a guidance counselor. She can't remember specific acts of being a guidance counselor.
So
this is a fairly well-known distinction.
So, Stan, you mentioned that was your interest in time and problems of time got you into this field. I want to go back to Ken's question and make that connection. That is, lots of the things we think are memories are inaccurate. Lots of the things we think we remember about ourselves are inaccurate. Now, evolution probably gives us faculties that helps us survive. That's very nice of it. But the question is the did evolution care that much about the accuracy of our memories? I mean, it really matters to remember that fire burns and hurts, but does evolution really care whether we get little facts about our teenage years right any more than it cares about what the really true history of the Boer War was? Or are those facts just kind of irrelevant to our functioning?
Certain facts are going to be constrained by the environment. So if you don't remember that fire is hot, you'll pay a price. Other kinds of knowledge we have, episodic-like knowledge of what we did, where we did it, when we did it, have more of a social function. But the bottom line is, in situations where the environment does not make us pay a price, we go with what works, not what is necessarily
yeah.
veridical.
But you know, this is one thing we haven't focused on a lot, but you've mentioned it in passing a couple times. Look, the self isn't just about me, because I'm just one self among others, right? And John Locke said that the notion of a person was what he called a forensic concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, has to do with assigning praise and blame, responsibility for including responsibility for action. So one of the things we do when we remember that I did it, or I remember that you did it, is like, you're responsible, not me. We separate self from others and distribute responsibility over self. So, you know, episodic memory, if I say, I don't remember doing that, and you guys all remember, yeah, you did that, you were there, I saw you, you know, I can't escape the responsibility by not recalling it. And that social thing, that social pressure on us to keep track of which of these selves did this thing, that's a really important pressure that seems to me to put some pressure on our memories being veridical, right? There's a social source of our memories actually matching the world. Otherwise, selfhood couldn't play this social dialectical function. What do you think about that?
I guess I haven't made it clear enough that I don't think that memory is unconstrained. There are social constraints and environmental constraints that make it necessary for us to, under circumstances, understand moral culpability. Maybe we want to avoid it. Another thing memory enables us to do is cheat.
Yeah.
We can remember what we said and what we didn't say, and we can alter reality in a way that my dog can't.
No, I wasn't trying to say that you denied it. I just wanted to stress, because we talked about two things about the self-conception. The synchronic integration of the self,
right,
and the diachronic narration of the self over time. But there's also something else that's important about self-conceptions. Locating ourselves as one self among others and then being in all these different relationships with those different selves. That's I think that's part of why we have this capacity for I thought, so that we can relate ourselves to each other in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I think certain aspects of the self, especially the episodic aspect, I believe episodic memory per se is a social evolution. It is not there to enable us to remember where the lake was. That, not that it can't do that, because anything that's evolved is going to have byproduct functionality. But I do think that it's largely there to enable us to achieve, and this becomes self-reinforcing, with different use of the self there, it enables us to keep track of the complex social structure, which has incredible positive adaptive advantages for us.
David in San Mateo's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I'll be talking to somebody, and I'll state something as fact, and then they'll say, no, that didn't really happen. You must be dreaming. You must have dreamt it. What's going on there?
Good question, David.
Either they or you are right.
You take a lot of drugs, David? No, you don't have to tell us that.
No, I mean, we forget all the time. I mean, especially what we did and what we say. I mean, try recalling yesterday in some detail. Good luck. Although you know 80,000 words in your working vocabulary and probably a million in your active vocabulary that you can use, even if you don't speak it, you can understand. We know lots and lots of stuff, but when it comes to specifics, the what I call the episodic or aspect of declarative long-term memory, we're just not that good at it.
Let me ask a question that may push us a little out of our sphere of comfort. Locke claims over and over again that if you can't remember something, you're not faking. You really can't remember it. It's gone beyond all possibility of recall. Then you shouldn't be punished for it. He thinks you actually didn't do it, but one of the reasons he thinks you didn't do it is so he can justify his feeling that you shouldn't be punished for it. He's really worried about what God's going to do on the great day to make sure that everybody remembers the stuff they're going to be punished for. Do you share his view that Ken indicated he didn't in an aside a minute ago? Do you share his view that it's really unfair to punish for somebody for something that they don't remember doing?
Well, I mean, here are going way beyond anything that I have any expertise or even feigned certainty in. I think that, you know, if it's on videotape that Joe Schmo shot my 10-year-old, I'm not as concerned about what Joe Schmo does or doesn't remember. I want Joe Schmo off the street. And if I'm an advocate for the death penalty, then maybe more serious consequences.
Yeah, that's regarding Joe Schmo as a thing to be managed, I think some Locke might say, right, as a thing to be managed rather than a person among others. Because one of the things about this, you know, one of the things about this self-ownership is that's the sphere in which we kind of really relate to others as fellow persons, as fellow selves. And if we say, that's just regarding something Joe Schmo is, you know, just something happened that Joe Schmo actually did. But if he doesn't remember, it's not part of his narrative. He can't give a reason. He can't argue for or against it. It's just like, in some sense, alien to him. I see Locke's point that it's not part of his self-story.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose Joe Schmo is a billionaire. And suppose he can't remember acquiring the money. Should he forfeit it?
You see, you're a philosopher underneath all that psychology stuff.
Speaking of that, so look, you've done all kinds of interesting work on memory and the failures of memory and the fracturing of memory and the fracturing of the self. Philosophers, frankly, haven't thought a lot about such things, although we're starting to think more and more, as John pointed out. If you were to rewrite the sort of textbooks of philosophy about the self and memory and all that, what are the main lessons philosophers should carry briefly from you psychologists?
I want to say two things about that. First, psychology and philosophy, as you guys well know, broke up 170 or so years ago for pragmatic, not pedagogic reasons. I think that these siblings have gone far too far apart. I do think philosophy has made more progress in reestablishing contact than psychology has with the new ideas that Sean Gallagher and others have about naturalizing philosophy. But I think that it's while it's important to naturalize philosophy, that is, rein in conceivability with empirical possibility, I also think that there's a lot of important research needs to be done so they're not just cherry-picking things that are consistent with theory. On the other side, I think psychologists, and this is implications for philosophy, need to really seriously consider philosophy because many of our concepts are stipulated and unanalyzed and unreflected, and we end up studying tasks more than we do concepts. We don't platonically cut nature at anything. And we would benefit from, not that philosophy has the answers, but from serious reflection on what a memory is. I don't think we have a clue what we're talking about when we are neurolocalizing memory.
Stan,
and I study memory.
Stan, you know, that's music to my ears, both sides of that. I love what you just said. And on that note of great joy, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a memorable conversation.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Our guest has been Stan Klein. He's a professor of psychological and brain sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's author of The Two Selves, Their Metaphysical Commitment and Functional Independence. So, John, what's your last thought here?
Well, I really enjoyed our conversation with Stan. There's a lot of psychologists now who just kind of debunk common sense concepts and say they're all false. Stan really digs in, looks at what philosophers have to say, and brings empirical research to bear on them.
That's really good stuff, John. This is really good stuff. This conversation continues. There's a lot more to talk about at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's test the short-term high-speed memory of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, if you go by movies and television, we're experiencing a constant epidemic of amnesia. Memento and The Bourne Identity are just two movies whose plots depended on amnesia. More recently, Walt faked amnesia in season 2 of Breaking Bad. In actuality, as usual, he'd been kidnapped by a psychotic drug dealer. In real life, of course, amnesia is extremely rare. Well, there's selective amnesia and cultural amnesia, which allows us to make the same mistakes over and over, and there are little pieces of forgetfulness that will probably always be with us. Frankenstein, for instance. We all know that Frankenstein is the doctor and the monster, don't we? Well, apparently not. Do we know that the thin man is actually the murder victim and not the detective? Of course we do. Do we know that Sherlock Holmes never actually said, "Elementary, my dear Watson"? We could just look these things up, but we take them for granted. The Wicked Witch never said, "Mirror, mirror on the wall." Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart never said, "Play it again, Sam." Dirty Harry never said, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" Cary Grant never said, "Judy, Judy, Judy." Greta Garbo never said, "I want to be alone." Are these just weird tricks of memory? What Winston Churchill actually said was, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." But blood, sweat, and tears look better on a record label, I guess. Alfred Lord Tennyson and the Charge of the Light Brigade didn't write "There's but to do or die." It was "There's not a reason why there's but to do and die," which is what they did. No or about it. Money is not the root of all evil. Love of money is the root of all evil. It's in the Bible. Look it up. Hamlet did not know Yorick well. He just knew him. Remember Houston, we have a problem? What the astronaut actually said was, "Houston, we've had a problem here. We've had a Main B bus undervolt." Doesn't have the same ring, does it? Here's another ringless quote. "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." Preach it, brother, except what Edmund Burke actually said was, "When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle." No wonder evil keeps winning. And did the evil bandit and the treasure of the Sierra Madre say, "We don't need no stinking badges"? Not precisely, he said,
"Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges."
The misremembered quote is more succinct, I suppose, but still. Oh, and there's, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." What Voltaire actually said was more like, "Think for yourselves and let others enjoy the privilege to do so too," which sounds like the valuable lesson you learn from a Disney cartoon. Speaking of cartoons, does this sound familiar? "I would have gotten away with it too, had it been for those meddling kids." That actual line was never said on Scooby-Doo. On the other hand, a line just like that was said on every episode of Scooby-Doo, so who needs memory anyway? That's why we have Google. As far as famous quotes go, when in doubt, just assume that Oscar Wilde said it. It was either him or Churchill. 9 times out of 10, I gotta go.
Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
I forgot armed robbery was illegal.